All right, we're coming earlier today than usual, and that is because I have an interview stream later on somewhere. I can't remember where now. Anyway, welcome back to the Deepest Lore, Horus. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me back. This is the big one for me.
We're going to start the Mayfest set. I'm very excited. And also joining, long-awaited return to the channel, is Simon Roberts. How are you doing, Simon?
Shall I do a Douglas Murray intro? Well, it's a very great pleasure to be here. my way in. Thank you very much for having me back. Good afternoon, AA. Good afternoon, Horace. Good afternoon, chat. Nice to be back.
I was there with you at the Henry Jackson Society.
He's purred more as he's got more successful, hasn't he?
Frightening.
Have you mastered Douglas Murray saying Hamas yet? That's his latest affectation.
Quite.
Anyway, last time I saw you, Simon, we were having a burger and various other disgusting things.
The Blair musical, yes.
At the Blair musical, that's right. Tone the musical. Oh my
yes,
god,
that was great.
I'm trying to remember who. Oh yes, it's Auros Press who is interviewing me later on, and I will share that in the chat, and I'll put a community note up now as well while I still remember. Hold on. Catch me here at 10 p.m. So, and then I really must put an end to these outside appearances. I've just done too many of them of late. But you have to kind of put the rounds in once in a while.
I like to do the kind of Henry Bullingbrook in Henry IV model of social PR. You know, like he says, by being seldom seen like a comet, I was wondered at.
Amazing. He's an underrated character as old Henry IV, I think. Much overshadowed by other characters in those plays. But anyway. Before we get going, I'll just remind everybody, do buy my courses. I'll play the ad. Which one shall I play? Why don't we go for the entrepreneurship one? It's been a while since I played that one.
Favorite.
Guard on the vocals, or is it Pharaoh on the vocals?
I think it is Guard. Yeah, I asked him if he could do an extended mix of it. I love that. That is my favorite. It's such a lovingly done sort of homage to kind of 90s trash telly.
He's got a hell of a vocal range on him, Guard, because he doesn't sound like, you know, he can go low and he can go high and
he can snap you like a twig.
All right. So, Horus, anything you'd like to chill before we get going, sir?
No, I'm sorry if my sound is a bit rough today. I'm on Substack. I believe you've put the link below the video if anyone wants to check that out. Yeah, I'm going into history, you know, putting together things in a different way than people have done before. So check it out.
Simon, anything?
Yes. Yes, I'm coming up on Nathan Hood's King Arthur Day on the 25th of May, doing a film review of Arthur on film. We're going to talk about Excalibur, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, possibly the Bresson film, Lancelot du Lac, and Mr. D will be joining us.
Fantastic. All right, so we're going to be making a start with the Mayfair set, but before we get going, Simon, you're something of a Curtis fan, and I think you've been watching along.
Yes.
Now, are we entering the classic Curtis period now, or do you think he's already hit his stride with the previous one, which was The Living Dead? I mean, I think they've all been fantastic, to be honest. Like every single one.
An Ocean Apart was quite a revelation, actually, going back and watching that again. I mean, the fact that they had a sort of crown jewel of the BBC in the form of a Dimbleby narrating that and putting his name to it was very intriguing. But I think you're right. This is the one where he really sort of kicks it into high gear. He's a completely competent documentarist. I mean, he's one of the sort of three top modern British auteur sort of essayists. I think the ones I like are people like Nick Broomfield, who did, Curtin Courtney, Biggie and Tupac. Jonathan Meads is another one that I like. He's got a very arch, funny style. I mean, for many years, the Mayfair set wasn't really around. I had a sort of ropey videotape of it, and it was one of the earliest uploads to YouTube of the Mayfair set. I sent it to this journalist I knew called Tony Gosling, who was a sort of conspiracy guy, and he was really keen to get a copy, and he uploaded it to YouTube, where it was for quite a number of years in my sort of, you know, crackly VHS version. And the reason you could tell it was mine was because he actually copied the whole tape, and I had a Jonathan Meads documentary on mid-century German architecture at the end of it. So he had all these comments of people watching it saying, oh, I really like the Mayfair set, and the documentary on Nazi architecture was good as well. So
Jonathan Meads picking up brutalism.
yeah, he's very good on that. He's got a couple of them, but I think this is certainly the one where he gets into that sort of collagist kind of characteristic style and really supercharges it.
You know, I've got a funny image because, in the late 90s and early 2000s, pre-easily available footage on the internet, I was into pro wrestling tape trading. And he was like, it was like getting the forbidden stuff from Japan and all that, you know, sought-after matches from... And I've just got an image of you doing the same thing, only with Adam Curtis documentaries.
Yeah, absolutely. I was completely obsessed. I mean, I saw it at the time in 1999, and I managed to get just one episode taped. And then UK History did a kind of bowdlerized edit of it a few years later, which cut about 10 or 15 minutes off. So I think the ones on YouTube now are more or less the full BBC edits, which is great.
All right, so let's make a start then. I mean, Horace, just before we're going, do you think this one, Mayfair set, is where Curtis truly enters like his kind of golden age, or do you think he's already there with The Living Dead?
I think this is probably my favourite one of his, so yeah. But I do agree with you, both of you, that the earlier stuff is really interesting. The Ocean Apart, especially, and The Living Dead, what's it called? Pandora's Box. There's loads of interesting stuff in there. But I think this is sort of like where you sort of talk of Curtis in his pomp, you know? This is where he really comes into his own. I'm not sure exactly what I mean by that, but it seems to all come together. And this, just one thing we'd probably all credit with him in general is just he takes us an interesting path through topics that you, at any rate, don't consider connected. He connects them and he takes a curious path through them that no one else seems to do. And that's what, you know, despite him being pretty hard lefty, that's what makes him so interesting, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's things to debate about that. I've written about sort of 5 pages of notes on his style. I won't sort of necessarily belabor any points at the minute, but I think you're right. He is kind of sort of libertarian left, he identifies himself as, but he likes to hover between different positions with different documentaries. And in interviews himself, he says, well, I don't really have a politics. It tends to be sort of reactive to the moment. And I mean, I think of Mayfair set as the first of what I sort of call his Destination Blair tetralogy. You know, it's this one, Century of the Self, Power of Nightmares and the Trap, which are all about the dimensions and sort of interplays of the managerial regime in the UK and the US as it sort of eventually came to be in the 1990s.
Well, I would just before we start, just highlight one thing that I've noticed from this that I wonder if others pick up on it as well. Just the number of times that he asks someone, you know, the talking heads that he's talking to, questions about power, and also how often the talking heads, without you hearing his question, they've obviously just been asked one of those questions as well. He just doesn't always show it, him asking it. It just brings up the question of power again and again, in this one especially, and in lots of his documentaries.
Yeah,
and, I think that does reveal his political views, actually.
Yeah, I took a quote from an interview he did. He says, what I think I'm most interested in is how power works in society, more correctly, how power is exercised, but in ways that we sometimes don't see it, especially in institutions that appear not to have anything to do with politics and power as we traditionally know it, flowing through scientific institutions, areas like consumerism and the way we think and feel about ourselves. So, and in the first shot of this show, obviously, he's literally telling you with the, you know, the placard on the guy in the first sequence.
I'm something of a I share this fascination with Curtis about power, so makes it quite a good fit for my interests. But let's carry on.
Britain's power and influence has declined since the beginning of the century, and the question is this a trend we can reverse?
We are concerned with making money. That is what we are trying to do.
It's been described as the most beautiful terrace house in London.
The abuse of business and financial power.
You lied.
We shall have a harder Christmas than we have known since the war.
Economic activity is best left to the private sector, with market forces being encouraged to operate.
Solemnly promise to swear to govern the people of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the Union of South Africa, Pakistan, and Ceylon, and of your possessions, the other territories, any of them belonging or pertaining, according to their respective laws and customs.
The coronation of Queen Elizabeth II was a triumphant assertion of Britain's power in the world. But it was held in a city that was still ruined from the bombing of 10 years before. Britain had been bankrupted by the war, and many of those clustered around the new Queen knew that it could no longer afford to rule the world. But one man in the crowd was determined that Britain should remain great and powerful. And if the old ways would no longer work, then he would find a new way. He was Colonel David Stirling, a war hero famous for founding the Special Air Service, the SAS. What Stirling would do was to sell to other countries Britain's military power. Britain would supply them with modern weapons and with mercenaries who would fight their wars for them. In return, Britain would become rich again and continue to influence the world.
Pause a second.
Go on, Horace.
He didn't do the thing of saying, like, but this vision turned out to be false.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking that.
But this vision does turn out to be false, just a spoiler for everyone.
But, I mean, just from our own perspective now, I mean, do you think Britain has had any influence on the world since the coronation of Elizabeth II?
You'd have to firm up the question a bit. I mean, yeah, we've had some, yeah, but...
Or is it just basically riding the coattails of the Yanks?
Yeah, we are the most abased of all the US's vassals.
Like, we do the soft power presentation, the window dressing.
The British Council. Yeah, the our rulers are slaves to the US. Like they willingly, they love it.
Yeah, I mean, because that would be the, you know, if Blair was here, he'd be saying yes, but if America went into Iraq alone, you know, they wouldn't have had anybody to lie to the UN for them, for example. Or I don't know, you see, like right now with Ukraine, they're there again, aren't they? Our government.
Instigating the trouble, yeah.
And I mean, I think it's the combination of, you know, the idea that America is not completely alone, like on Israel at the moment, for example, or with Ukraine, and also that permanent seat on the Security Council, which Britain can use, you know, to veto things or to... So I think those two things are played up as much as they can be, you know, for American interests, basically. But you could say, well, to the extent it has, the extent Britain has an influence, it's there somewhere in and around that. But let's carry on.
On the 14th of December, 1941, a small party of British troops made their way cautiously onto the enemy airfield of Tamit in the Western Desert.
Could we pause for a second?
It was a pitch black night.
Go on, Simon.
Just a factual correction there. That's not Field Marshal Bramall, who died a few years ago. This is actually Lieutenant General Sir Brian Horrocks.
Oh, they got it wrong.
Was wrong. Yeah, caption was wrong.
Interesting.
I knew that because I knew someone who worked for David Sterling. I knew an SAS soldier who was actually was friends with both of them. This guy was a bit of a character. He became a TV presenter later on.
Interesting.
And they were moving carefully for the very good reason that they were hundreds of miles behind Rommel's front line. And they belonged to an organization called the SAS, Special Air Service. They were really a private army, started, trained, and led by a young subaltern called David Sterling.
David Sterling came from a Scottish aristocratic family. With the SAS, he had invented a new revolutionary way of fighting a war. He had shown that with only a few men, he could destroy hundreds of enemy aircraft. To the army commanders, his methods were reckless. But to his supporters, it was a return to a golden age of British heroism.
The airfield was packed with aircraft. And they roared onto it with all guns blazing, the real Nelson touch, in fact. Now, the only way that I can bring this alive for you is by a demonstration which I've fixed up on this model for you to see what happened. Most of them had beards. A lot of them wore bandana handkerchiefs. They must have looked very like 18th century pirates. Now, what I always wonder is, how do men like this make out in peacetime?
After the war, David Sterling left the army and went to live in Rhodesia. Like many returning servicemen, he found post-war Britain drab and depressed. Sterling also believed that his duty was to help maintain Britain's empire. It was what he, like so many others, had fought to preserve.
He believed that he had that's the sort of thing that families like mine believed anyway until fairly recently, probably. I mean, that you were powerful, that your birth gave you the right to power, but also gave you very great responsibilities.
Pause for a second. Mm-hmm. Did Curtis deliberately put him the other side of a road so that we would see cars driving between him and his house? Like, that is deliberate, isn't it? I don't know what to what. I'm not sure, but that's intentional, isn't it?
Is that like modernity imposing on this old vision, something like that?
Yeah, severing the present from the past or something. Yeah.
The American highway in the middle, you know, intruding on the old British vision.
And it's a good point he's making about this loss of noblesse oblige among the elite. I mean, Stirling himself was very scathing about the kind of officer class in, if you like, what they call the line regiments in the military. Obviously, the SAS was a new concept in the Second World War, but it encountered a lot of resistance to the kind of innovation he brought. And the sort of descriptions of them as pirates is kind of appropriate because they did sort of, you know, recruit a lot of kind of ne'er-do-wells and people who were in trouble with the law. And, you know, later on when they were trying to get money out of the MOD, they'd always be turned down for things. I mean, I was told by my friend, who was a warrant officer called Mel Parry, he died last year. And he was saying when they tasked Mel to go and set up a territorial unit of the SAS, they just really wouldn't give them any money. So what Mel would do would, they would sort of go into deserted military establishments and just sort of, you know, ransack bits out of them and flog them off at auctions in order to get the funding. And you know, if they needed a power generator or something, they would just drive around, see a council power generator by the road, nick it, paint it green and say, that's ours now. And so they were kind of, you know, very, very much sort of this maverick buccaneer, you know, kind of mindset. And Stirling thought of the British elite. He called them the Freemasonry of mediocrity. And famously, he described them as layer upon layer of fossilized shit.
Amazing.
Looking after the people who lived on the place or worked on the place. It's just in the blood, I think, too. You know, it's a birth thing. It's a birth thing.
The British do not give independence or freedom to anybody on the platter. You have to fight them for it. You must be prepared to go to prison. To face imprisonment or even death itself. They do not give it to you as a present.
In the 1950s, black nationalism.
Yeah, go on.
Just a quick note about Hastings Bandar. You know, we did Black Power about Ghana the other week, and it was
Gold Coast. Yeah,
yeah, and Kwame Nkrumah. He was, you know, he was one of the sort of anti-British, not crazy, not like Maoist types like Mugabe, but anti-British sort of decolonialists. Who nevertheless lived happily in London for about 10 years before Hastings Bandar. I think he was like a doctor or something. No, maybe not in London, sorry, but in Britain. Loads of these guys, you know, they didn't find anything wrong with, like, you know, living in Britain and making a good living there.
Mm. I always remember that bit, though, that guy. I kind of love him in a way because it's just a brief lesson in the raw power realities of dealing with the British elites. They don't give you power as a present. You've got to fight.
So I actually wonder if they do. And the reason I asked that question is because of the book I've got here by another one of these post-war military types, Major General Richard Hilton. The book is called Imperial Obituary, where he basically lays out how there were even plans before the war to give away various different territories. And he outlines all the ways in which the elite did not really fight that hard. You know, I mean, his view is that harder force could have been used in every single colony to hold on.
In terms of divestment of empire, yes. I'm thinking as we face our modern elites.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, I mean,
I didn't pick up on that at first. Yeah, exactly.
That's a good point. Go on.
I think before the Second World War, those who were for holding on to the empire sort of by force and you know, really making an effort to do that were called the diehards in the Tory party. And they were just a section of the Tories. I don't think there was any movement across the whole elite that was specifically very acutely pro-imperial. It was complicated, but like the diehards in the Tory party were already in a rearguard action in the 30s. Obviously, India being one of the main issues. I just thought I'd mention that.
Yeah, I mean, Richard Hilton, who I mentioned there, set up a league called where he was part of this thing called the League of
Empire Loyalists.
Yeah, the League of Empire Loyalists, right, who were considered basically like a hard right group at that time. Various other, Arthur K. Chesterton was part of them.
Julian Amory was one of them.
Yeah, Hilton, like I mentioned. John Tyndall, Ironside was one of them. You know,
I think Bowden might have been in it as a young man as well.
It's possible. Yeah, he was probably in and around this milieu at some point. You know, so that they are a somewhat forgotten group in the history of the British right, I would say. But I have found that they're, if you can find books written by people who were in that, they're kind of eye opening, you know, some of the forgotten details. But anyway, let's continue.
Spread through Africa. To try and stop it, Stirling set up his own political party called Capricorn Africa. He proposed an alternative form of power sharing where people like himself would civilize the black majority. It attracted wide support among the white middle-class settlers, but it was firmly rejected by politicians in London.
There are many people who take what you might call a sort of paternalist view about the African in Africa. They say, and this no doubt is true, that the European, for the time being at least, because of his greater knowledge and know-how and the rest of it, can run things better. And then they jump from that to assume that the European should stay there in control. Now, I've never accepted this analysis. It was about 50 years ago that Asquith said that self-government is better than good government, and I believe this to be true.
Pause.
I mean, it's 65 years later now, mate, and we're still waiting.
Can I tell a little story about this? I did a little bit of digging on this guy because you could sort of read where this is going. This chap Ian MacLeod, he was the secretary, colonial secretary, I believe, and he was responsible for much of the divestment of places like Nigeria, Tanzania, Sierra Leone, British Somaliland, Kuwait, and Cameroon. And interestingly, there's a couple of little anecdotes I found, actually. This is a guy who I found there was an article on Unheard about him. So and a sort of approving article. So he's kind of Unheard's kind of guy. It's an article called The Tory Playboy Who Toppled the Toffs. So they make this guy out to have been a gambler.
He was a
bridge player. Not the Claremont, but at a place called Crockford's, another club. And this article is interesting. It says, quote, he made his mark within 2 years of arriving in the Commons in 1952, facing off against Nye Bevan. To have a debate on the National Health Service without the Right Honourable Gentleman, he told Labour's Health Secretary, would be like putting on Hamlet with no one in the part of the first gravedigger. Amid the laughter, watching from the front bench, Churchill leaned over to an aide and said, who is that man? Put him in the government. And interestingly, this chap MacLeod, he didn't have a seat in 1945, so he contested the Western Isles constituency in the election, and there was no Conservative Party standing. So what he did was he set up an inaugural meeting for a Conservative Party nomination, and literally no one else turned up but him and his father. And it says his father was a lifelong liberal, but an admirer of Winston Churchill, and they were the only attendees. So what happened was MacLeod, he elected his father as the association chairman, and then his father selected his son to be the candidate. And then they got in due course a letter of endorsement from Winston Churchill. And the funny part is he actually came bottom of the poll. He still lost by only getting about 2,700 votes out of 13,000. He's Churchill's man.
So Churchill's fantastic skills coming into play at more. Once again.
I've always heard MacLeod praised by left Tories. Like he was praised as a moderniser, like a Cameron, Francis Maud sort of figure. So
he also has resemblances to Gove, a sort of backroom, you know, player character. He also held some of the same offices. He held the Duchy, Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, which seems to be reserved for kind of Tory wets. And he was thought to be a very good debater.
Interesting that Unheard like him. I've often wondered who that publication is for. Maybe it is for that the left Tory, you know, the left Tory.
The One Nation.
At the end of the 50s, Stirling returned to London. He was angry and disillusioned with the politicians. He felt they had lost the will to maintain Britain's power abroad. He also had nothing to do. He spent his time in Mayfair at private gambling parties.
Four, giving you three, is drawing a card.
The parties were arranged by another young aristocrat, John Aspinall.
I first met David Stirling when a friend of mine brought him along to one of my games. David, as a gambler, was very brave, reckless, of course, as you would expect, dangerous, because those sort of gamblers always are. He was quiet, but menacing in a funny sort of way. So with David, you always knew he'd strangled 41 men, and therefore it gave the man an aura. One wondered how many throats he'd slit.
In 1962, John Aspinall opened his own gambling club, the Claremont Club in Mayfair. Stirling was one of its members. The Claremont was deliberately designed to recreate a time when Britain had been rich and powerful.
It's been described as the most beautiful terrace house in London, built between 1742 and 1744 by William Kent, the royal architect, for Prince Freddie of Wales, who would have been King of England if he'd lived, but he died, I think, at the age of 39, for his mistress, the beautiful Isabella Finch Hatton.
Trying to recreate some sort of 18th century world. The beauty of the decorations, the colour of everything, the abandon, sheer extravagance of it. And it was an atmosphere and an ambiance where strange plants could grow.
The set that Aspinall gathered around him at the Claremont were, like Stirling, disaffected right-wingers, men who felt themselves out of tune with the consensus politics of the post-war world. They included James Goldsmith, a playboy and ferocious gambler who was to become a close friend of Stirling's. The tycoon, Tiny Rowland.
I should just mention, doesn't Goldsmith become something of an obsession for Curtis moving forward? So he's one of the people he keeps on coming back to, isn't he?
Mm. Stirling already knew from his time in Africa. Lord Lucan, a descendant of the man who had led the charge of the Light Brigade. And Jim Slater, the takeover tycoon and asset stripper, who ran the notorious Slater Walker. What you know?
I just say, Lord Lucan, there, who famously murdered his nanny in 1974. And I think there's an idea that John Aspinall, who ran the Claremont, used to sort of cover his massively inflated gambling debts, and then possibly also covered his escape from the UK. But I don't know, Forrest, you know anything about the case?
I don't, but why would he have covered his debts?
Don't know. I think he was just a guy they liked to have around. I think they called him Lucky Lucan or something, but he just kept losing tons of money. And then I think eventually he became a bit of an annoyance. And there was an ITV drama about it a few years ago where I think the implication was that Aspinall had him bumped off and dumped in the Channel.
That would make sense if he owed him loads of money and it wasn't going to come back, I suppose. Mm. Well, maybe.
What united all these men was a belief in decisive, reckless action. It was this, they believed, that had made Britain great, not moderate post-war governments.
Some people actually seek risk.
I think there is actually something to be said for their point of view. I mean, whether you describe it as reckless or not, but you can see where they were coming from. That risk-taking and, you know, going out into the world and adventure were kind of the things that the spirit that built the empire in the first place, not this kind of creeping managerialism that you see after the war. So you can see where they're coming from.
Totally.
And Curtis mentioned there, like, you know, he contrasted it with, what was it, moderate post-war governments. I mean, just anything that implies disparagement of the moderate post-war governments gets my approval immediately. I mean, we're talking about a dirigiste economy being imposed at that point, right? In the late 40s, 50s, and so on. When Churchill and Eden and Macmillan got in, they expanded the welfare state. They expanded, you know, state direction of the economy and stuff. So it's a depressing time for people with talent and for, you know, people who don't want to be part of some agreement between company, union, and whatever. You know, it was all going against people with actual initiative and talent. So I sympathize as well.
And they put themselves at risk voluntarily. And I think this is a spirit that is to be admired. I think it's the spirit that built the prosperity that everybody in this country is enjoying today. It was created by adventurers, by merchant adventurers, by pirates, if you like Morgan and Drake.
Then, an event occurred in the Middle East, which gave Stirling the chance to try and reassert Britain's power abroad, but in a new, different way.
Interrupt again, but it just kind of occurred to me that essentially the arguments they're making are very similar to the arguments that Bronze Age pervert makes today. It's kind of like this is Bronze Age mindset, you know, just kind of post, you know, 1960s style rather than, I mean, it's basically all the same arguments. And I was wondering whether some members of the Israeli government today have got themselves into this mindset, because there is a certain degree of this spirit in Netanyahu, love him or hate him. He is basically the entire world is condemning him, including portions of the American government now, and he's just going like, yeah, fuck it, I'm doing it anyway.
Is this account of the age of Schmittian decisionism, you mean?
Yeah, he's just going for it, you know. Which I mean, obviously, I've not been a fan. I'm not a particular fan of Israel, as everybody knows. But from a certain point of view, I can kind of, it is bold, decisive, and risky action, in a way that is totally uncharacteristic of our leaders.
In September 1962, Egyptian troops invaded the Yemen. They went in to support a military coup against the ruling Imam. The invasion terrified the West because President Nasser of Egypt was backed by the Soviet Union, and he now threatened the oil fields of Saudi Arabia.
We have our troops there. We minimized the number of our troops. It depends about the attitude of Saudi Arabia, because if we leave Yemen without agreement, they will try to return the Imam back to Yemen. We'll stay there until we reach agreement with Saudi Arabia.
How long do you think this is going to be?
I don't know. We are ready to stay there for 10 years.
For the British, Nasser threatened far more than just oil. The Yemen overlooked the British base at Aden. It guarded British trading routes throughout the world. And right-wingers in the government feared that if the Egyptians, backed by the Soviets, attacked, they would paralyze Britain's economy. Their leader was Julian Amory.
The prosperity of our people rests... Sorry,
maybe I should have said this after, but just he was the son of Leo Amory, who, I don't know if he was counted as one of the Tory diehards, but he was certainly always spoke in favor of the empire, although in his actions he did the exact opposite and supported Churchill and the war and helped destroy the empire. But yeah, Julian Amory was his son. Julian Amory also joined, I think Leo Amory did as well, but Julian Amory joined Churchill and a lot of the other sort of left of the Tory party at the time in supporting the European movement and beginning to get the idea of common Europe, you know, a common market and then a European Union off the ground. Just a little arcana as well, like Leo Amory had another son who I believe became one of those people who propagandized for Germany during the war, despite having like a Jewish grandmother. Like Leo Amory's mother was Jewish. Despite that, sided with Nazi Germany and propagandized for them during the war. Quite funny.
Wow.
Really, on oil of the Persian Gulf, the rubber and tin of Malaya, and the gold, copper, and precious metals of South and Central Africa. As long as we have access to these, as long as we can realize the investments we have there, as long as we can trade with this part of the world, we shall be prosperous. If the communists were to take them over, we would lose the lot. Governments like Colonel Nasser's in Egypt are just as dangerous.
David Sterling was a close friend of Julian Amory's, and together they were determined to find a way to stop Nasser. But Nasser had humiliated Britain once before at Suez, and they knew the British government would do nothing officially to stop him. They had neither the will nor the money. Sterling and Amory had dinner with the...
I should just mention, by the way, that from a completely different point of view, from the Egyptian point of view, you could say, or from a Avolian perspective, there's something to be said for Nasser and that whole project as an interesting one. My buddy Panama Hat looked into that in the past and talked about some of the intellectual influences behind Nasser as a kind of revolt against the modern world. So it's kind of interesting. But anyway, let's continue.
Foreign Secretary Alec Douglas Hume at White's Club in St. James's. They proposed a plan. A group of ex-SAS men would mount an operation to fight the Egyptians, but they would do it privately.
In this particular time, we're talking about in the 60s, British governments had lost the will in some ways to engage in this sort of operation. There was a great need for stability. There was change taking place all around. Revolutions, coups, and we could do something which the British government no longer had the will to do, helping to get rid of a foreign power in the Yemen. So it was logical for private enterprise to pick up this particular challenge. And particularly as we felt it was very important for British national interests.
The British government agreed to the idea. Sterling would help to organise a private war in the Yemen, but they wouldn't have to pay for it, and no one would ever know they were involved. But Sterling's team now had to find the money for both men and weapons. In secret, a member of the team flew to Saudi Arabia. Sterling already knew Prince Faisal, the most powerful of the king's sons.
Sorry to interrupt again, but it does make you wonder how much of this stuff goes on today, doesn't it?
Just to add something here as well. This is... Oh, sorry. Sorry, go on.
Go on, Horace, go on.
I thought you'd finish. Well, just to add that this is 5 or 6 years after the Suez fiasco, just for anyone who's not aware of that. And Nasser was sort of the victor of that and became a lot more powerful because obviously he won that. He'd come into power shortly before Britain, Israel, and France attacked, and he was a lot stronger for having survived that, and for implicitly having the support of the US as well, despite being aligned with the Soviets.
Can I just say it's interesting that footage of Amory speaking to the public, in a very raw and direct way, saying, "Well, you know, we need the rubber and the tin and the copper. You know, we need these resources." This sort of very, you know, candid, sort of carnivorous kind of political view that you can't see a politician today sort of doing that, fronting up and saying, well, basically we need their stuff. That's why
they still act on that. They still act on those motivations, but they never say that now. Yeah.
But there's never that kind of bluff, directness anymore.
Faisal was terrified that Nasser would invade his country next and agreed to the British idea. The Saudis would pay for the war.
Saudis saw David as a sort of their idea of a buccaneering Britain, an unusual who talked to them as if he was almost an Arab. Well, he didn't speak a word except for sort of localized Arabic. I don't think he had any sort of pidgin Arabic, but he talked to them as they understood him and respected him.
The Saudis' use of Sterling was nothing but an expression of need. They needed his services. They didn't have anybody with his expertise. They didn't have anybody of his stature and ability. That is very, very simple. In his case, I think to say that he was a mercenary is to sell him short. He was a mercenary, and simultaneously he was an extension of British policy. He wasn't doing anything illegal. This government knew about it and approved it. And therefore, he was sort of a merger between a mercenary and a Lawrence of Arabia, if you wish. You know, he brought these two things together, the romantic adventurer and the modern-day mercenary, came together in the person of Stirling.
The Saudis agreed to pay for the British mercenaries and also to smuggle weapons into the Yemen. The man in charge of the weapons would be a young trader, Adnan Khashoggi. Khashoggi found the weapons that Stirling's team needed from Britain and America. Hundreds of rifles and machine guns left over from the Second World War.
They were not the type of arms they could get from their usual sources. They needed specialist arms, so for mountain warfare, guerrilla warfare, and things like that. That, of course, signaled the emergence of Khashoggi as an arms dealer. His first arms deal, Adnan Khashoggi's first arms deal had to do with the war in Yemen.
Pause for a second.
The other...
That guy, Adnan Khashoggi, obviously went on to become maybe the world's most famous arms dealer. Like, he's in and out of the news here and there, in various different, you know, involved in various different conflicts over a couple of decades after this. And then obviously his son was Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered, well, he was disappeared, wasn't he, from the Saudi embassy in Istanbul, I think. He went in there, I don't know if he was lured there or forced to go there somehow, but he never re-emerged. His body was presumably disposed of in the embassy. And yeah, he's like, obviously, I think he's of Saudi background, but was a renegade spy. I mean, people said he was a spy for Qatar, but it seems, I mean, I'm basing this on the book by Mark Curtis, one of Mark Curtis' books. He's a nutbag leftist, really, but his books are quite informative. But yeah, he describes in that how, like, arms dealers get involved in, you know, they become courted by various intelligence agencies and obviously politicians because of their role as sort of intermediaries in conflicts.
And also
their favour matters, doesn't it?
Social cachet as well. I mean, I remember, you know, Khashoggi was a kind of sort of very seen as a sort of very glamorous kind of figure in the 70s and 80s. You know, he was the typical profile that intelligence services look for of, you know, the popular, wealthy industrialist who has lots of parties where, you know, he connects to lots of people, lots of networks. And I always remember, you know, I think he had a massive yacht or something like that, didn't he? It was always kind of being talked about. And he was always sort of being seen with kind of, you know, the supermodel types. And, you know, he was very much a sort of international jet set figure that people, you know, sort of forget now.
Probably benefits somewhat from spy mania as well, doesn't it?
Very, very interesting. Yeah, I was thinking Bond sort of figure, figure that you'd see as a bit part in a Bond film, something like that. You know, characters based on him is what I mean.
The problem was to find the men. Stirling set about tracking down his old comrades from the SAS, but who had now left the regiment.
He said, you'll be leading a very small party and you will have professional soldiers with you, indicating that I was going to take professional SAS men in with me.
But this was not an SAS operation?
No.
What was it?
It was an international operation, supplying the Arab forces, training them, upsetting the Egyptians by mining their roads, ambushing, general nuisance. Mounted by governments who knew about it, but were not intimately connected at all stages.
So, if things went wrong?
If things went wrong, I'm afraid we would take the rap.
In 1964, an intrepid British aristocrat, Lord Kilbracken, made a film record of the British mercenaries' war in the Yemen. He travelled to the remote region where they were leading the royalist troops against the Egyptians.
The desert seemed endless. We saw only a barren, rocket-scarred mountainside, no tents, no houses, but up to 800 soldiers inhabit its caves and crannies. This is the Royalists' HQ. Here we met two of the British mercenaries. After morning drill, Bob and co. would take their ease in the sun outside the cave which housed their radio station and was their safest air raid shelter.
That photograph was taken at about 8,000 foot above sea level. One had to be disguised, otherwise the information would get back and the Egyptians would come and bomb you. Parts of out and out war, mortaring and shooting up of their convoys. The capital was completely cut off from Hodeida, their supply route from the sea. And we kept the Egyptians really tied down, and at one stage were completely running the country.
If the tribesmen were properly led, which is always terribly difficult, and properly directed, then we, with a small force, we could achieve a great success against a conscript army who didn't really want to be in the Yemen in the first place.
Pause for a second. Just for anyone, I never heard of this conflict until I watched this documentary, but anyone who wants to learn more about it, you could also watch End of Empire, which is a, I don't know if it's ITV, it's a British series from the 80s, I think, and it's it covers this in one of the episodes. It's a pretty good series.
Yeah, not much talked about this conflict, is it?
Never heard of it. It's like, it's almost though, I don't know, it just doesn't really fit with the history that we're taught. There was also the fact that Egypt united with Syria around this time. They actually formed like a two-country union.
Pan-Arabism, was it? Oh.
It's like, yeah. It was like the United Arab Republic. I think it lasted for not very long, a few years. Mm. They actually consensually united two countries.
Wow. A lot of this stuff wasn't really discussed until the 90s, the so-called secret wars that Britain fought, especially in the sort of early 70s in Oman, which I think he covers later. This wasn't sort of, you know, really very openly acknowledged.
It was very exciting. It was very exciting because at one stage one actually thought one was changing the course of history. And I think one felt that we could create countries in a better image if they were tied to Britain. It probably an incredibly arrogant thing to say. But we just felt that we probably could.
What was invented in the Yemen was a new, private form of foreign policy for Britain, paid for by other countries' money. But then, at the very moment when Stirling's team seemed to be on the brink of success, an economic crisis hit Britain, which threatened his whole concept.
I should mention that is a classic Curtis segue, isn't it? But then...
Events then, crashed in.
Yeah, something happened.
In 1964, a new Labour government was elected. Almost immediately, there was a run on the power.
Mr. Brown?
Yes.
Have you been discussing the economic situation this morning?
We've been discussing the affairs of the nation, yes.
Have you got any money here, John Harvey?
Faced with Labour's promises of increased social spending, the markets panicked and began to pull their money out of Britain.
Sure. Nothing at the moment.
A lot of the essential economic decisions for a government were taken externally and not inside the country at all.
And who were they taken by, those decisions?
They were taken by investors abroad deciding where to put their money. By bankers abroad deciding where to put their money.
Sorry to pause it, but do we believe this is what happened to Liz Truss like recently? Similar thing, really, isn't it?
If you could think of someone more inept than Dennis Healy at financial management, yeah, named Liz Truss. No, something like that. That thing that happened to Liz Truss was blatantly organised by loads of different people. That was an attack. It was, we're going to get rid of her, like, today, and they did it. No, I don't think it is the same thing, because this is what Labour, I don't know if they still do this, but they did this for a long time. They always complain that there's a massive capital flight from their attempt to basically seize everyone's capital. They think that's really out of order. I've seen, like, articles, many, many articles over time, where they describe this happening President Mitterrand took over in France in about 80, 81 or something. And, yeah, just a massive capital flight from the country, obviously, because he's he's proclaiming that he's going to impose a much more socialist economy. Obviously, the returns of keeping capital in this country are thus diminished, right? So you try and get ahead of that. You try and preserve your money by getting out before the government can get it. Leftists think that's really out of order. And Healey, well, I know he's on the right of the Labour Party, but it's the same thing here. It's like, yeah, they're running away from your threat. You are a threat to them. So, yeah.
I mean, famously, this was what Taxman was about by the Beatles, wasn't it? The Beatles also fled during this period, did they not?
Yeah,
and in Taxman it says, "Ha ha, Mr. Wilson, ha ha, Mr. Heath."
Yeah, and also it's interesting that you sort of sense what's creeping in here is a realization that they can kind of, by this sort of increasing marketization of the economy that Curtis is driving towards, you can then distribute risk away from people like Stirling and his band of mercenaries, let's say private military contractors, you'd say now, you can distribute the risk away from those sorts of people who are, in a sense, your old-fashioned, organized military elite minority who can take over countries with a small amount of resource because they have that expertise, they have that buccaneering ruthlessness, and a way for governments to sort of disavow or disacknowledge that or put it at arm's length is to sort of farm responsibility out, like Healey is saying here, oh, it's the international markets that do all this stuff.
I don't know why we were getting Fs in the chat. Well, why were we getting Fs in the chat? What happened?
Is it because I went a bit free market rhetoric? Like, is that alarming to people?
I don't know.
Pro property and stuff.
Don't seem. No, I think there was buffering or something. There was buffering.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I'm sure it will still be there on the replay because, as far as I could see, we were still on air. So, All right, let's continue.
And by youngsters like the ones in this room, who are speculating, sending billions of dollars across the exchanges every day in search of short-term profit.
Oui, je peux vous donner 5 millions de francs belges.
It was a battlefield with the markets. They were pressing for big increases in interest rates, increases in taxation, cuts in spending. And the markets can still do that to any country in the world.
The effect of the economic crisis was dramatic. To save the pound, Labour decided on wide-ranging spending cuts. And one of the main targets was defence.
Pause for a second.
Dennis Healey had been made Minister of Defence, and in early 1965 he began a series of enormous cutbacks.
I just want to take issue with what Healey said, that the markets were calling for higher taxes. No, they weren't. No, they weren't. Of course they weren't. That's absurd. You mean this? That's just... You know, he's just referring to what he's prepared to contemplate. Obviously, markets never call for higher taxes.
And it's the same displacement, isn't it?
Yeah, yes.
He closed the overseas bases and brought the troops who had once protected the empire back home. It was a deliberate end to the idea that Britain was a great power.
I would really like to make this point very strongly. I don't think it is worthwhile spending a lot of money to try to change the course of history outside Europe or to protect national economic interests in foreign countries.
Pause.
We can't go on being the...
It's the classic speaking in the Blair mode of inevitability there, isn't it? We cannot stand against the tide of history. This is all happening.
True. Do you guys remember... Oh, and Obama, obviously, the arc of history bends towards progress, as in what we want and so on. Do you guys remember when Dennis Healey died about 5, 6, 7 years ago?
No,
his eulogies, his obituaries, sorry, in the papers were, I think, unanimously strongly praiseworthy. Right, he was beloved by the whole media class in Britain and politicians, basically because he was totally unprincipled. Because he was right between, you know, he was in his own party. He fought the left. He kept the left, the ideological people, out of power. And so the Tories and the Telegraph and people like that, they love him because that's what he wants. He just wants politics to be one continuous fix of the centre ground.
So you've got a proto Blair, if you want, or proto Kinnock.
Exactly. And in the same way that a lot of the centre-right press likes Blair, right? And a lot of Tory Blair party
goes,
admire Blair.
And Blair goes one further. Healey there is kind of almost pleading with you, making an argument, well, this is the onrush of history. Whereas, as you say, very often, Blair just says, well, it's already done. It's already happened. We've already decided. The train's already moving.
Just another note as well, may or may not be relevant. Where, you know, we all know that Blair was quite pro-Trotsky when he was at uni. Healey joined the Communist Party of Great Britain in the 30s, apparently not out of any sort of Marxist conviction, but just because they were standing up to Hitler. So, yeah.
Great.
Policemen for the whole world on our own forever.
Healey believed that instead, Britain's defence industries should make money for the country. The Americans were selling weapons throughout the world, and Healey wanted Britain to compete with them and to earn precious foreign currency. He appointed the country's most famous car salesman to advise on how to do this. He was Donald Stokes, head of Leyland Motors.
We're no longer a great world power. We're a commercial trading country now, and the sooner we appreciate this, the better. And unless we get the economy right, unless we get industry prosperous, it's no use politicians doing or thinking anything because they've no power left anymore. We've no power of armies or air.
Can I just say that there is something to the idea that if you keep on repeating something, it becomes true. So, you know, like Healey is obviously a declinist. This dude is obviously, you know, there's an argument to say that had Britain followed the course outlined by some of the other chaps who we've seen in this documentary and the league that we mentioned before, they could have gone into the post-war period in a very different mindset. I mean, do you think there's any chance that they could have rebounded rather than come to this notion that essentially Britain was a glorified used car salesman now?
Do you want to take that, Horace, or should I?
I think the tragic irony of it all is that trying to hold on to the empire was part of the cause of the war, and the war was the cause of our financial ruin, which was the cause of needing to dispose of all the colonies. But probably a lot of the colonies should not have, you know, money-wise, were never wise to acquire in the first place. I think a lot of this really was inevitable because of the war and because some of the colonies were bad colonies in the first place. Mm. I don't think a lot of this could have been avoided. However, the calamitous decline, the way that Britain, you know, kept declining by mistakes, basically, and bad decisions and bad people in charge, that, well, in the sense that anything could have been avoided, that could have, but, you know, it was all set in train a long time before.
Mm. And it maybe is, I mean, for what I've read about Stirling's Capricorn Africa project, this was an idea of a sort of a power sharing, you know, between, you know, former white colonials and the black majorities in African countries. But that might have slowed down the process of decay, perhaps. But this sort of the voting franchise he was proposing there was still a very qualified elite franchise. So it perhaps would have seemed like British colonial rule, perhaps just, you know, just easing down at a much slower, more graceful pace. As you say, though, it may well just have been the inevitable.
Is what he proposed similar to what Ian Smith tried to do in Rhodesia? Because that was a sort of, there was some allowance for some, like, you know, black African input, but it was still largely overwhelmingly weighted towards the whites of Rhodesia, you know, to ensure that they stayed in charge, really. And I was quite frank about that.
Presumably that things ran as well.
Right, because it was just guaranteed disaster if you just suddenly let all the blacks vote. They would just vote in someone like Mugabe or, you know, some communist, basically, and just wreck the country. And, of course, that is what happened.
And maybe the sort of the strong man model that was present in the Arab world was being looked at and, you know, anticipated in Africa. And obviously we see that play out a little later on with people like Idi Amin and Mugabe and Kenyatta.
Air forces, the only power we've got left is economic power, and we must deploy this for the benefit of us all to the best advantage to get the best return. Well, we could be so prosperous if only we could get some sense into this.
But Britain was not very successful at selling weapons until David Stirling decided to get involved. Stirling was furious with Healey's defence cuts. They had come at the very moment when he had finally won the war in the Yemen. In August 1965, Nasser effectively surrendered. He signed a ceasefire with the new king of Saudi Arabia, King Faisal. Nasser promised to begin withdrawing his troops from the Yemen.
Just say it's remarkable to win a war purely with secret proxy forces. Mm. Quite an achievement, that.
We produced a situation where we'd won, where the Egyptians were prepared to pull out completely from the Yemen. They went to see King Faisal in Jeddah and agreed to go. And it was at that time that the new British government announced its intention to leave Arabia. So we'd actually won the game, which was probably why I got so cross. We'd actually won the game. And then it was given away politically because the Labour government was committed to a major defence cut.
Sterling believed that Labour had given away the fruits of his victory. By removing troops from the Middle East, they had left Saudi Arabia defenceless. Above all, with no air force. So Sterling approached King Faisal and offered to create an air force for him, privately. But first, Sterling had to find the planes. To do this, he went into partnership.
Can I just say, by the way, I have always struggled to learn the different Saudi kings because they always just look like that. I can always remember, like, you know, like at the minute, it's the Crown Prince, MBS, right? Mm. And for some reason, the way that the Saudi royal family runs, it's always the Crown Prince who does a lot more of the hands-on stuff. And then there's a king somewhere. Mm. And it's always something like Faisal or some name, you know. And I even forget who the king is now. What's his name? He came out to meet Putin, which was a big deal because nobody ever sees him. But
just call him Abdullah. Just go with that.
I just always get confused with Saudi kings, but anyway, let's go.
With a flamboyant British entrepreneur who lived in Jeddah, Geoffrey Edwards. Edwards went everywhere in a white Rolls Royce.
I live by exporting, and in many countries the Rolls Royce is regarded as the highest possible status symbol of someone's achievements. Everyone seems to want to own a Rolls Royce, or at least ride in one. In fact, many of my friends often say to me, the only chance I shall ever get to ride in Rolls Royce is at my funeral in a hearse. But amongst foreigners, it does have a great effect upon them to be met by a Rolls and think, this is something, particularly to a chap you've never met before, and you're talking in terms of millions, which we often are doing in my particular game, or various games, I should say. To be met by a Rolls means to him, here's a man of substance, this is a man who has something behind him, we can trust him, he's good for his word, and money's good, etc., etc.
Hey, I think you've just stopped the feed, the documentary, I mean. Hey, can you hear us? You're on mute.
Oh, sorry. I don't want to labour the point about the Saudi kings, right? But I have to show you this, okay? This is the current king, King Salman, okay?
That's quite Salman, yeah.
Yeah, King Salman. There's Abdullah.
Wait.
Here is Fayed. This is the one before Khaled. There was Faisal. There was the one before him, Saud. They all look the bloody same. I mean, I'm not being like they've. It's because they all have the goatee and the same shape. I mean, are they? Is it because they're all brothers or something? They're all related, aren't they?
They are all related. Yeah, they are.
So.
And inbred as well, probably.
I always just think they look like Alec Guinness in Lawrence of Arabia.
Together, Edwards and Sterling came up with an extraordinary scheme. They would persuade the British government to sell the brand new Lightning fighter to the Saudis, along with an entire defence network. And Sterling's team of ex-SAS men would help to run it. Saudi Arabia would be protected, and Britain would maintain its influence in the Middle East.
Well, the arms deal was brokered by Geoffrey Edwards and David Sterling, and the package would involve British planes, British training for the pilots, British training and, in the start, maintenance for the aircraft, and ground control, radar, and everything else. We were there prepared to give a training support, and we had already shown, you know, in Yemen and other things, that we had been a capability of doing it.
In a private way?
In a private way.
They wanted aircraft, radar, training, and guided weapons. The Lightning was an extremely sophisticated fighter aircraft, supersonic, the first British supersonic fighter aircraft developed by English Electric, and they wanted the very latest type of fighter aircraft, and they wanted the latest type of radar. And of course there were all sorts of security problems. The attitude of the embassy in Saudi Arabia was very lukewarm. It was gaining influence through trade. But the Foreign Office had not been involved in trade. It was thought to be slightly below the salt trade. Diplomacy was tip-top.
But Dennis Healy was in favour of the deal. It was a perfect example of what he wanted the Ministry of Defence to achieve. He gave it official government support. But Stirling and Edwards were facing serious opposition from the Americans. The Lockheed Corporation were trying to sell the Saudis their Starfighter instead. They produced slick commercials to show off the plane. They also took the precaution of hiring an agent in Saudi Arabia, Adnan Khashoggi. He told Lockheed that the only way to win...
Here he is again, look. But by the way, on the Saudi kings being related, what I meant was is that they're all brothers or something. I think all of the kings have been had the same dad or something. But the current king,
I think they were all the last few since Faisal have all been sons of Faisal. I think that's how it goes.
This current one, Salman, is the son of the founder of Saudi Arabia somehow. I mean, he's ancient. He's like.
So they've all been kings of the sons of King Saud.
He's the 25th son of King Abdulaziz Al Saud, who is the founder of Saudi Arabia.
Who is apparently a very sanguinary tyrant.
So, I mean, he just had a metric fuck ton of sons, and every single one of them has been the king at some point, I think.
And they're still going.
And they're still going, yeah. He's still the king now. So, anyway.
Just a brief correction for the plane and autists in the chat. The bit of footage he used there wasn't a Starfighter. It was an F-4 Phantom.
The deal was to bribe the Saudi government. 10 years later, in a Senate investigation, Lockheed's chairman admitted what had happened.
I'd like to ask Mr. Cowden... this question. Did Mr. Khashoggi inform you personally that if Lockheed was to obtain contracts in Saudi Arabia, public officials there in a position of influence would have to be paid off?
The answer to the question is yes. He has told me on several occasions that it was necessary for him to make payments to Saudi officials, government officials.
Stirling and Edwards told the British government they would have to do the same as the Americans. Pay commission to their agents in King Faisal's entourage. If they didn't, Britain would lose the deal.
Did you pay commissions to get this deal?
We paid commissions to our agents, yes.
Did you think that was wrong?
No. The agent lays out a lot of his own money, and if he doesn't, the deal doesn't go through, he loses his money. On that basis, I think it's a fair way of working. I knew some of the things that went on in Saudi Arabia, of course. The payments were made to people. I would not call them bribes. They were payments, a cut on the deal, for people who were involved in it, and that was the custom of the country. They have different ethical standards to ourselves. For instance, people in Saudi Arabia have lots of different wives. We don't have that in this country, but it isn't a good reason for not doing for failing to do business with them.
When the British government accepted the principle of commissions being paid, it was looking the other way on an act of corruption. They knew this was corruption, but they thought of it in terms of this is Middle East corruption. This is the way things are done in the Middle East. And I would have dared anyone at the time to tell Sterling that he was not behaving honorably. He believed he was behaving honorably. You could accuse him of a certain level of naivety, but you could not doubt his honor in terms of serving the purposes of Britain. But the activity...
Can I just say, one of the interactions I had, the reason I knew people who used to be in the special forces was I worked for a period in the defense industry in 2009. And this sort of slightly belabored moralizing that's coming across here about you know, corruption in the arms trade. I mean, that's just the way it works. I mean, I've stood in an embassy of a country east of here in London with an agent for some military stuff. And, you know, the agent and the we come in and, you know, they give you cups of tea and fancy biscuits and stuff. And then the agent disappears off with the ambassador into another room and there's an envelope handed over. And, you know, that's just the way the defense industry works in those sorts of contexts. You know, that's not remarkable.
10% for the big guy. I think we're all aware of it now, aren't we?
Yeah. I'm assuming it still goes on. People get taken on junkets, stuff like that. You know, it's all part of just, you know, oiling the wheels. So I don't know, maybe I'm deeply corrupt in some way. I just found this sort of, you know, slight a shock on his part, a bit performative. I think Sterling would have been naive to it.
If you're moralizing about the arms trade, you know.
Yeah.
There's also obviously, I mean, the way that they do, the way that, you know, people can be incentivized legally in Britain as well. It's just you get promised a directorship for afterwards, for, you know, after you're in your current role. You know, so there's always that, which is legal anyway. So there's always that option as well.
Yeah.
By nature, corrupt.
In December 1965, the Saudis announced they would buy the British planes. The bribes had worked. It was the biggest export deal in Britain's history, and King Faisal came on a state visit to celebrate it. It was also the beginning of the modern arms trade with the Middle East.
Do you think Queen Elizabeth lost track as well? When she was, you know, she must have met them all at some point or another, being like, "Oh, Faisal, nice to meet you again. Oh no, I'm Abdul or whatever, you know."
That's probably why she played it safe, didn't she? She said she liked all the presidents of the US. She liked all the kings of Saudi Arabia. She got on well with all of them.
Yeah. Oh, hi, Your Majesty.
Which has grown to dominate Britain's economy. And from it also came a much wider commercial relationship with Saudi Arabia.
It gave us a great leverage in. It brought a lot of Britons in at a time when there were very, very few. And a lot of things came along as byproducts of this particular deal. Deals for hospitals, deals for all sorts of things, deals for building roads, deals for building palaces, deals for building airfields. It all came as a byproduct, a major, major, major byproduct. So this £100 million arms sale came to be worth billions in terms of trade for Britain. And also, it maintained our influence there to this present day.
With the Saudi deal, Sterling had reasserted Britain's power in the Middle East, and it had cost nothing. But it was only the start. As the limits of Britain's official power in the world became ever more clear, Sterling found other ways to secretly influence the policies of other countries. And again, he would run it as a business. By the late 60s, many of Britain's former colonies were being torn apart by civil war. In Nigeria, the federal government were fighting a vicious campaign to stop Biafra from seceding. The British government were secretly supplying the federal side with weapons. Their aim was to protect Britain's oil interests in Nigeria. But the Sunday Telegraph printed an internal government report which exposed this, and there was an outcry. The man who leaked the report was an idealistic young journalist, Jonathan Aitken.
If you had known in advance how much trouble it would have caused, would you once again have passed on that report to the Sunday Telegraph?
Oh, my goodness, that's a difficult question. I think the answer really is this, that given that situation of that ghastly war going on, and given the fact that I believed I received that information in good faith, I think it was my duty as a journalist, and indeed as a citizen of this country, to pass on that information. So I think the real answer is, yes, I would do it again.
Pause.
Go on, Simon.
His moralizing will come back to haunt him later in the series.
Do you think any journalist today working for any of the major newspapers would say that? What he just said.
Can slime talk?
There were protests throughout Africa. Britain was seen as helping the Nigerian government to pursue a policy of genocide. The scandal also split opinion in Britain.
Should we stop sending arms to Nigeria? Whether this would have any effect or not, should we stop sending them now?
Sorry to interrupt, but I long for the days where television is simply four men in tuxedos.
Middle-aged men.
Middle-aged men.
Smoking studios.
Smoking, talking about serious matters.
So this, yeah.
I'd love it if TV was just that. I'd watch TV all the time if it was this.
Yeah. Hugh Fraser.
To my mind, it's a very simple, and the answer is yes. The alternative is, as it's proposed by people like Woodrow Wyatt and an MP in the Times today, is to keep up with the Russians. This is morally absolutely intolerable. It's politically inept. Your policy is losing out. You're making a fool of ourselves throughout the world. The people are regarding this country with moral obloquy. It's not this merely question. The policy has failed.
If we don't supply arms to the Nigerian government, the Russians are going to go on doing it. The Russians have told the Nigerian government that whatever happens, they're going to see them through to victory. Well, is it wise that we should allow the whole of this vast area, with 52 million people in it, with more oil in it than Kuwait, to fall into the hands of the Russians? I mean, it's absolutely crazy.
Pause.
God,
just a footnote. That guy, Woodrow Wyatt, he was married four times. He was a lank-haired stud.
Amazing, because I was just thinking that, like, if he was around today, he'd probably just be an incel on the internet or something. But back then, he was a man who wielded power, influence, and obviously had the ladies too.
He ran the tote, the British gambling company. So, like, lots of people in this political set, they're all into gambling.
Interesting. I like the fact that the Conservative used the word, what did he say, obliquely on mainstream television.
Yeah, you better get a better class of insult.
Federal government won, helped by the British arms. But the resulting scandal clearly showed the limits of Britain openly using arms sales as a tool of foreign policy. As coups and civil wars spread through the Third World, Stirling was determined to find a subtler way to maintain Britain's influence in the world.
Is that African Ugandans doing kind of Scottish? They're wearing Scottish kilts, but they've added a bit of shuck and jive there, I noticed.
A bit of freestyling with the march, yeah.
Sorry, Horace, go on.
I was going to pick up on the exact same thing. Like, why are we watching black Africans playing bagpipes? but yeah, like with some tribal dancing or whatever you call that.
I think it just shows the wonderful eye for footage that he's got for archive.
It's quite a nice homage to Scottish traditions as well. I just don't know why East Africans are doing it.
I want to see the shuck and jive again, because it's kind of watch this now.
As coups and civil wars spread through the Third World, Stirling was determined to find a subtler way to maintain Britain's influence in the world. He set up a secret organization called WatchGuard. Its job was to provide African and Middle Eastern leaders with a private army of British mercenaries. They would prevent the leaders that Stirling approved of from being overthrown.
The idea behind WatchGuard was to use David's expertise and connections with the SAS to enable these governments in their early years to have a fully trained and expert security, similar to what we have in this country for government ministers and travelling ambassadors. It was to enable them not to be vulnerable to violent overthrow.
For the avoidance of any doubts, the following are emphasized. A. The President, the Vice President, and all ministers and their deputies are dismissed from office. B. Parliament is dissolved.
I even feel like there's been a decline in the quality of African dictators. Yeah. Even the Africans have declined.
He's kind of quite a stylish beard cut there.
You look like you'd be hanging out with Lionel Richie or something, this dude.
C. The Council of State is abolished. D. All political parties are proscribed. It is therefore illegal for any person or persons to belong to or operate under any...
One of the things that often happened for a coup, for instance, was for the radio station to be taken over and people to announce that the government had been overthrown. So one of the things we did, for instance, would be to have alternative radio stations which would come on to demand, to say that this is simply not true.
WatchGuard was a great success. Stirling organised protection for leaders in Africa and the Middle East. And as his mercenaries got close to the leaders, they also became influential.
You know, I can't help but think, watching this episode, that I wonder how much of this business has been given up to the likes of the Wagner Group today. Because, you know, if it was back then, it was Stirling and his crew doing it. Now I'd just imagine Wagner would be all over this sort of stuff. And we know that they're there doing this sort of thing for the governor, the new government of Niger, for example. So
anybody who was involved in the personal security of any ruler gets very close to that ruler and to his ministers. Very close indeed.
And how much influence can one then have?
Immense.
In Oman, many of the Sultan's advisors were ex-SAS men. They ran the Sultan's guerrilla war against Marxist rebels. The rebels made a propaganda film attacking the Sultan and his British mercenaries. But the British won.
Militarily, how secure is Oman now?
Militarily, totally secure. I believe that there is no way in which the enemy can recapture those positions down there. And there is no other way in which he can bring supplies into Dhofar to sustain a revolution.
By the early 70s...
Do you want to pause, Oros?
Yeah, if I'm correct, that Sultan Qaboos who won that war, I think he or his heir is still in charge in Oman now, and Oman is still very strongly aligned with Britain.
Yes.
I think, you know, regardless of obviously the end of the Cold War. I think, just again, not really relevant, but I think Oman also used to have quite a big empire down the east side of Africa, like a trading slavery empire. I think Zanzibar was one of their main sort of trading sites.
I've actually been to Oman. It's one of the few kind of Arab countries I've been to in the Middle East. And the place I went to was just like this huge palace. Immaculate, just some like not a speck of dust on the floor anywhere. It was but vast. The buildings were vast, and there weren't that many people there. But that was the only thing I can remember about Oman. I probably went to a bit where only tourists go, I imagine. But
Sterling had become a successful businessman. He arranged enormous arms deals, and his mercenaries kept many Third World leaders in power. Almost single-handedly, Sterling had created the foundations of Britain's modern, privatized foreign policy. It is a hidden world of vicious guerrilla wars fought by British mercenaries, a world that occasionally surfaces in scandals like the Sandline affair. It all began with Sterling selling Britain's military power to countries he approved of.
Pause, as long as these countries were friendly countries.
Go on, Howard.
I don't know, maybe Simon, do you know, was the Sandline affair what Mark Thatcher was involved in?
It was a guy called Colonel Tim Spicer. It was back in the 90s. It was a sort of attempted coup in New Guinea. That I remember it happened because I was living in Australia, and then I came back to live in England, and it was happening around that sort of time. So I was vaguely aware, but Sandline was quite a big issue at that time.
New Guinea, as in Papua New Guinea?
Papua New Guinea, yeah.
Oh, right. Mark Thatcher did get involved in some attempted coup in Equatorial Guinea, but that was in the 2000s.
Mm.
But Mark Thatcher was also involved in like taking advantage of his mother being prime minister when she was prime minister. Some sort of trading in the Middle East. I can't remember which country. But yeah, Sandline was different from that. So yeah.
Okay. Yes, I think there was an SAS involvement in Equatorial Guinea, a captain called Simon Mann, who was put in prison out there, and he eventually was released. I will just go back briefly to the Oman thing with one of my sort of boring anecdotes about my past. I've done work in the private medical sector and in London, and you do a lot of patient work with people from the Middle East, and embassies send their patients over, you know, Kuwait, Qatar, you know, UAE, all that sort of thing. And you learn very quickly that unfortunately the bureaucracies that run the embassies are very poor at paying you for the doctor's time when you're billing, you know, for consultations and things. And sometimes they can just take like a year to pay your bills, things like that. They're absolutely hopeless. And I instituted a policy of basically saying you either pay up front or you don't get treated. The one embassy that we never ever had a problem with was Oman. Completely solid, completely honorable.
Interesting, very interesting. Just before I play the end of this, now, I know the Americans have kind of stuck their nose in a couple of times and actually were defeated in that one deal. And Curtis has stressed that it's Sterling's personal preferences that are, you know, dictating what he does. But I do wonder whether wider geopolitical goals had anything to do with what he was up to. Like, did all of this have the tacit acceptance or approval of the CIA, for example? Because I have noticed that basically Sterling is keeping out commies most of the time. Do either of you have any inkling on that?
That Yemen conflict involved Marxists for sure. I know that.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like he's keeping out Marxists and keeping broadly pro-Western powers in. So,
and NASA was sort of aligned with the Soviets at the time that fight happened as well.
Yeah, I do know from my contacts with the SAS people that, I mean, again, I'm this is ancient history stuff now, so I'm not really spilling anything amazing. But yes, they did work with the agency out in the Arab Street a lot, and the nickname they had for the CIA was Clowns in Action.
again, I have a flashback to the Bond films of the 70s, whenever the CIA dudes turn up in their Hawaiian shirts, you know.
yeah, they're mainly like sort of semi-civilian field officers rather than, you know, sneaky military types.
Please, where there was no conflict between Sterling, the ultimate expression of Britishness, and the policies of that country, he was certainly willing to provide his services in terms of buying arms, in terms of training, in terms of undertaking missions, actually. He was a man of many parts, a dynamo, a very likable man. So he was acting in a private capacity, but he was acting in cahoots with the British government. There's no doubt about it.
And that was new?
That was new for a private person, yes, yes.
Sorry to, I'm actually not sure about that guy's take that was new. I can imagine in the 19th century, there was a ton of stuff that was done, quote unquote, privately like this. Hmm. You know, I mean, most of the African colonialism that we think of as private endeavors, you know, whether it's you can name all the famous African explorers or conquerors or whatever. They were often men working on their own initiative. So,
and India was acquired largely by private means as well, right?
Initially, yeah.
And then sort of taken over by the empire, as it were. But there was large parts of land owned by trading companies, right?
Yeah. So I'm just not sure about this take that this is so unprecedented what Stirling is doing. If anything, he's just kind of reverting back to the old status quo of, you know, the situation presents an opportunity, you know, for your interest to align with wider interests, something like that.
But then, in the early 70s, Stirling had a terrible car crash in the Scottish Highlands. He nearly died and spent a long time recovering at his family estate, Keir, in Scotland. Stirling was forced to give up all his mercenary activities and his arms dealing. He went into semi-retirement. His crusade to keep Britain powerful seemed to be over.
As Prime Minister, I want to speak to you simply and plainly about the grave emergency now facing our country. In the House of Commons this afternoon, I announced more severe restrictions on the use of electricity. We are limiting the use of electricity to 3 days a week. The reason why is quite simple. The problem of the supply of oil and the problem of the rise in the price of oil. Jobs will be in danger and take-home pay will be less. In terms of comfort, we shall have a harder Christmas than we have known since the war.
The price of oil had been massively increased as a result of the Arab-Israeli war. The oil-producing states, led by King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, were furious at American support for Israel. Their action had catastrophic effects on the...
Can I just say, that is... Did you used to watch Tintin when you were kids, like the cartoon?
Read the books.
That is the absolute, like, you know, Middle Eastern
racial caricature.
The sneaky Middle Easterner. It's like, I mean, it's just...
He should have a curved dagger, though.
Dear, it's
ridiculous how much he looks like that.
A curved dagger under the cloak would complete
the Western economies.
Doesn't this new massive increase in the price of oil mean a change in the world balance of power between the developing nations like you, the producers, and us, the developed industrialized nations?
Yes, it will.
And what do you think arises from that?
Well, a new type of relationship. You have to adjust yourself to the new circumstances. And I think you have to sit down and talk seriously with us about this new era.
In 1974, David Stirling came...
We've got to dwell on this guy for a second.
Right? He's great. Shake him, Arnie.
He's aware that that's a historic moment as he's saying that, doesn't he? He's aware that no one of his kind has been able to do that before, to just smugly smile in your face about the change of power.
Yeah. He's aware that he's bending you over an oil barrel and pulling your pants down.
If you want to be crude about it, Simon, yeah.
Afraid so.
Crude. Get it?
He's crude.
I'll take credit for that.
Yeah. He's just got a funny twinkle in his eye, his expressions as he leaves, a sort of pause, you know, to let the other guy know.
So I've often wondered whether some of the climate stuff is ultimately about removing the smug look off that guy's face. You know, stripping away the leverage and kind of position and power this has given those couple of key countries in the Middle East since they came into the oil.
It was very impactful at the time. I remember, you know, you had things later on, like Not the 9 o'clock News would make jokes about how the Saudis had, you know, more or less bought up all of London. So there was kind of a sort of passive aggressive resentment in the air about that, you know.
Still is with Russians buying up property in London as well, isn't there? I'm a bit offended AA, that you suggested just a moment ago, that the climate movement may not all entirely be as grassroots as it seems, but I don't want to dwell on that.
I will say that, speaking of the Russians, I do remember that back when the Ukraine war started, there was a bit of a conspiracy bit doing the rounds, suggesting actually that the Russians were behind a lot of the climate stuff because it favors oil over gas. It favors gas over oil.
Yeah, there is some substance to that. I remember when fracking started to get really big in America, and RT was dead against it, and it was blatantly because it was diminishing Russian hold on oil sales, I think.
Interesting.
Came back to Mayfair. He found it completely transformed. It had become the social centre for the oil-rich Arabs, and the Claremont Club had changed too. It had been taken over by the Playboy organisation, and they allowed Arabs in for the first time.
When I took over at the Claremont Club, Arabs had been excluded from the Claremont, and we opened the doors to them, the very rich Arabs who were gamblers. And that made the club. I was able to pay for the club in 6 months. We sort of maintained the exclusivity by only inviting those Arabs who were big gamblers to join the Claremont too.
Again, it's what one brings to the table. Arabs knew that they were mixing with the likes of British aristocracy, and their passport was money. The Arabs had their money. The English, maybe that Claremont crowd, felt they had their aristocracy, their lineage, their sheer snobbery. They knew the Arabs would have loved to have been part of it, and they could pay the price. It's nothing new here. I mean, we had aristocracy marrying heiresses, American heiresses, to bring money to the families. This is nothing new, but it was blatant in the 70s. It was in their faces.
One has to say, putting it as tastefully as one possibly can, that I think some of them are a little unfamiliar with the Western laboratory. I mean, I can understand that, you know, if you walk in and you haven't seen one before, it does look a very strange and unsympathetic object. And quite obviously, rather than using it, an awful lot of them have preferred to use the floor. And unfortunately, without clearing up some of the mess over a long period.
What has been the result of that in the flats?
Well, its main unpleasantness is...
Oh, that's it.
Oh.
My version of it cuts off there. So we've lost the last couple of minutes, but that's it. It's finished.
How far? How many was just a few minutes from the end?
I think we were just a few minutes from the end. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, he goes on to say that the do you want to do
it's
it?
It's a great phrase, isn't it? Yeah. Go on, do it.
I can't do it all, but he says that basically people started using the toilets wrongly, like standing on the toilet or crapping onto the lid. I don't know what exactly, but yeah. And he says that the smell began to spread through. I think he shared a building with them. So he said, the aroma of Levantine remains will be with me till the day I drop.
Yeah, brilliant.
In his perfectly posh accent, you know.
Much more elegant time. Yeah, yeah. Interesting thing there back on the Victor Lounge there. By
sorry,
the way,
not elegant enough to just avoid the subject though.
No, wait. Victor Lounge there, who was running the Claremont that time. By the way, he was the guy who financed the first Monty Python film, and the woman there, Marilyn Cole, who's called a receptionist, was actually a Playboy playmate. I researched her in some detail last night.
I noticed was it her who mentioned that marrying foreign heiresses. Yeah. That's obviously Winston Churchill's parentage, right? His father was not the Duke, but he was of the Duke of Marlborough's family, and there had been immense wealth, but they run it all down by the time he came around. And he married Jenny Jerome, I think. She was, for her money, like a British aristocrat marrying an American woman for her money, and apparently she was just basically a strumpet. But that was Churchill's thing. So he was half American.
It turns out there's quite a bit left, so I found a full version that we'll watch the end on YouTube here. Yeah. All right. Let's carry on. I will say, by the way, that if you go to any of those kind of posh places in Mayfair now, any of the famous hotels, for example, or, you know, you cannot help but notice the sheer number of Arabs who are there with their huge cars and their, you know, Saudi number plates. You can see, you know, they're everywhere in those places, even now, I would say. So let's carry on.
That I think some of them are a little unfamiliar with the Western Laboratory. I mean, I can understand that, you know, if you walk in and you haven't seen one before, it does look a very strange and unsympathetic object. And quite obviously, rather than using it, an awful lot of them have preferred to use the floor. And unfortunately, without clearing up some of the mess over a long period.
What has been the result of that in the flats?
Well, it's... main unpleasantness has been the smell, which has come up the ventilating shafts with such ferocity on some afternoons that we haven't been able to go into the bathrooms. I mean, I must say that the aroma of Levantine remains, and they will be with me to the day I drop.
The other effect of the oil price rise on Britain was industrial chaos. Government attempts to hold down wages led to violent strikes. To Stirling, it seemed as if the country he had fought to keep great was now collapsing from inside. So as a man of action, he decided he was going to do something about it.
He felt that the country was getting out of control, that again, stability of this country was now really threatened. He felt that the extreme unions were very dangerous, that there was a sort of possibility of of undemocratic action taking place in this country. And he felt that this was a time for planning a contingency operation to stop this happening.
David Stirling returned to his traditional recruiting ground, the clubs of Mayfair. He formed an organisation called Great Britain 75. It was a group of military men, many of them ex-SAS. They planned to take over the running of Britain if the strikes led to the collapse of civil order.
Based. How based is that? Can you imagine?
I remember the phrase man of action made me think of Mussolini. I think he was described as a man of action back in his time. And it's a funny, it's a very much a 20th century thing, I think, that you're described as sort of, you know, exceptional or odd if you don't want the state to be overthrown by the mad left. You know, that's exceptional in the 20th century. Mm. That's fascism. Mm.
Just a recommendation on this. There's a good film out there, if you hunt it down, called The Lost World of the 70s, which covers this period where you had these old military guys planning to, perform executive action at that time.
And they specifically thought Harold Wilson was probably working for the Soviets, didn't they?
KGB. It was a joke in the Special Forces, but yeah, that's what they used
to say. Which, as far as I know, was completely wrong. I don't think he was. He was... not even particularly sympathetic to them, but they became convinced that he was.
Comic hyperbole.
If a political strike is going to cause the country and the economy irreversible damage, we're there to come in and help to avoid that occurring. And we also believe that if we didn't exist and the left-wing activists create this situation of this general strike, which would result in the surge being out in the streets within a few hours in certain areas. And we believe that government would be unable to negotiate under that sort of duress.
You talk about patriotism, but surely your organization is an indication that you haven't got much faith in government to deal with the situation.
I've got awfully little faith in the present situation of Parliament as a whole, whether it's conservative or socialist. If we had that,
I love this stuff. Sorry.
But there's that question, isn't it? You know, that interviewer, this sort of slightly skeptical tone in which he addresses him, talking about, well, you know, you say you're a patriot, but it's that subtle change, isn't it? It's the managerial class in places like the BBC suggesting that patriotism counts on loyalty to your government.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is the case.
That's very salient. I've heard that use. I've heard the use of the word traitor begin to be applied to nationalists in the last couple of years. I notice Otto English at the moment is is making a thing of, oh, well, I won't go into that, but it's the idea that we are anti-British for being against the government. Yeah, that's being used again right now.
And we thought that the government could deal with this handful of left-wing activists, there'd be no need for our existence.
All those in favour of that procedure, please show.
Sterling also formed a secret organisation within the trades union movement itself.
It's not courage.
Its job was to fight and undermine the left-wing union leaders.
I actually love this guy. I love this guy. I wish this guy was around now, if he could see the fucking state of things. Somebody who just thinks, right, I'm going to put a plan into action. We're going to infiltrate the fucking unions. We'll take over the government if needs be. You know, I'll call my old SAS friends in.
Mm.
You know, this is like, do you remember QAnon? We're like, yeah, there are white hats. There are good guys on side. This is like, it's actually being real. This dude actually existing. You know?
Have some quiet, will you? It's quite out of order. People to interrupt the way.
One of Sterling's main supporters was
a group of people who understood what was happening and would fight and do something about it.
Experienced, over.
Kate, I must tell you that if you do not leave the rostrum, Kate, if you do not leave the rostrum, right, I will switch the power off.
You're wrong. He planned it like a military operation, and he would teach us to identify at any particular point in time what the next job should be, what our next move should be.
Look at that.
He's very good at this.
Pause that for a second.
He would say,
brilliant. Great illustration of women as the enforcers, zealous enforcers.
Yeah, I just love it. I love the fact that he's kind of playing them at their own game, making things that look organic, but they're actually planned. It's just fantastic stuff.
Anyone who wants to read about operations like this, especially in the Cold War, there's a book by Brian Crozier, who was an intelligence agent and various things, a journalist as well, who talks about, he had a role in this. I think he was running this lady. And there was another guy called Frank Chappell, I think, or Frank Chappie. I can't remember how it's spelled, but he was, you know, a trade unionist who the whole rest of the trade union movement hated because he was so blatantly just working with the right, working with people like David Sterling.
I love it. Honestly, I wish those guys were still around, and then we could imagine the fun we could all have. Anyway, let's carry on.
Well, you know, now is the time to make this move or that move. I suppose it was a bit like being in the army.
Much of the money to fund Sterling's operations came from his friend at the Claremont Club, James Goldsmith. Like Sterling, Goldsmith believed that politicians no longer had the power to control Britain. It should be done instead by men trained in what he called executive action.
Let's make it quite clear.
I'm loving this. I love the Mayfair set. Yeah. I love the Mayfair set.
Oh, at least this side interest is go and look at some of those interviews with Goldsmith. I think you've covered some of them before, actually. But there's the BBC two-parter on him. It was a Panorama special. And the second part was an interview with Goldsmith. And he's just this wonderfully bullish character.
Just loving this talk of executive action and just bypassing the official channels. We're just going to fucking do it ourselves. I love it.
That if you take a nation, which is one of the most prosperous, one of the finest, one of the most dominant, one of the most influential in the world, and turn it in 20 years into a relative pauper of Europe, an invalid of the world, everything has to be wrong and everybody is to blame. Our tradition is that the leaders in Parliament, in government, are drawn from Parliament, from the House of Commons principally. People with practically no experience of executive action at all. Now, what I'm suggesting is that they are not equipped for doing that, taking that executive action, and that they should be drawn from the nation.
Pause for a second. I mean, maybe I'm stating the obvious, but there is one clear reason to like people like James Goldsmith. It's just that he identifies Britain and goodness and what he's working for with strength and domination and excellence and achievement, right? It's very not leftist, you know. It may be strange. It may be that he was too aggressive, not particularly likable character as such, you know, and he's got a funny speech impediment and stuff, but he was trying to stand up for what was strong, not just nice or compassionate, but strong. And that's just, that's admirable, you know, whatever else you say about him.
At this very moment, power was taken away from the British politicians, but not by Stirling or Goldsmith or their friends in the clubs of Mayfair. It was by the Arabs. The very people who Stirling had once tried to control now stepped in to change Britain's domestic policy. In early 1976, the markets started to panic about Britain's economy. Foreign investors started to withdraw their money, and the pound slid dramatically. This crisis was far greater than Britain had ever experienced before, because the markets were now so much more powerful. And the reason was Arab oil money.
The power of the markets had increased because of the explosion in oil prices, which meant that the Arab countries particularly, which produced the oil in the Middle East and had no way of spending it internally because they had very small populations, had to find somewhere to put it abroad where it would earn as much as possible through high interest rates and, of course, increase in value through appreciation. And this totally transformed the international financial climate. And that meant that a lot of the essential economic decisions for a government were taken externally and not inside the country at all.
It dropped 100 points. We don't know why. It just dropped 100 points when everything else was staying steady.
Through the summer of 1976, Arab oil money continued to leave London. The heads of Arab banks now became powerful figures. They appeared on British television and explained what the government would have to do to save both itself and the country.
Unless really action is taken to put confidence again in Stirling and in the British economy, I believe unless this happens, money is bound to fly from London. Everybody knows the economy has been destroyed through strikes, rampant strikes, organized strikes. I feel that the position is so serious now that we should, that you should consider a sort of a coalition government where actions should be taken for the interest of the economy of the country, regardless of what effect they will have, because this, in the long run, is in the interest of the public in general.
Would these tough new measures that you've spoken about bring Arab money back into the British economy?
Absolutely.
They were worried because there was a Labour...
Sorry to pause here, but is he suggesting that this Arab intervention, call it what you want, was a direct prelude to Thatcher coming in? Is that what he's saying? That this is the post-war consensus was over and somebody's going to have to smash the unions for the good of the economy?
What are you asking? Is Curtis, or is the interviewer saying that the Arabs intended that, the Arab guy there intended
it
that?
Is not the, well, the interviewer couldn't have known because it was, but okay. is Curtis suggesting that Thatcher's around the corner because of this?
Yeah, the price of continued confidence is to break the unions.
So when was it that Britain went to the IMF for a loan? Was that 75?
76? I think that's already happened, hasn't it?
Was that a bit earlier? Was that 73?
I think it was 74, 75.
74 is what I've got in my head.
Yeah, under 70... Labour, right? Was it?
No, it's Heath again.
Under Heath, bloody hell.
Yeah, and he took us into Europe as well.
Unilaterally, yeah.
Yeah, and then this is 76. And I can't remember exactly when Callaghan comes in. Callaghan comes in soon, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think 76 Callaghan came in. And in 76, I think it was when he made that speech saying, you know, I tell you in all candor that we have to just adopt the new type of economics where we do care about debt and so on.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's kind of forgotten a little bit, that some of the stuff Thatcher did actually was started under Callaghan.
Yeah, Labour turned to what they call neoliberalism, yeah, while they were still in government. A few years before the Thatcher, yeah.
We see that in the next episode, yeah.
The government, it didn't seem to have control over what the trade unions were doing. A rash of strikes, of course, sent trade and output plunging. And it was quite natural that the markets would react by wanting to get out of sterling and into dollars, or Deutsche Marks in some cases, but mainly dollars.
Can I just say that I recently did a stream on a book by Michael Hudson called Super Imperialism that goes into all this in some detail. And there's a bit more, let's just say, American fuckery behind the scenes that basically ensured that this would happen, that the dollar would be effectively that there'd be a run on the dollar at the expense of all other currencies. it's explained by Hudson really well in there. So
that is what dollar hegemony really is. That is what it's about. It's about American supremacy via currency exchange. Yeah, like currency exchange rates. That is what it means.
Is that power?
Well, yes, it is, but there are a million ways of defining power, but if power is the ability to produce changes in the behavior of other people, then of course the markets do have very strong power, and the markets did compel me to change policy.
Pause a second.
Dennis Healy began a series.
Go on.
You might call that power, but it's a different meaning of the word, right? I mean, the market is a mass of people, not act. I mean, you know, they obviously, they collect, you can observe it as one collective thing, but they are acting individually. Nobody's under the control of each other in the market. So you can call it power, but it's really just the loss of power. It's the diminution of state power to control the economy. There was some ability. Obviously, before the world became more globalized, it was possible you could speak of national markets and a state could have some control over it in the sense that the several national markets hadn't connected up in every way, right, before what we call globalization. As globalization happened, that became less viable. And obviously, the gold standard was a factor in that, which was an international money system, effectively. Mm-hmm. And then in the post-war world, there was an attempt in certain ways, a kind of new mercantilism, but also not mercantilism because that's competitive and this was supposed to be sort of stable. And this time, the mid-70s, is the breaking down of the currency system that had obtained until then, when there was largely a consensus of fixed exchange rates that were beginning to float at this point, and then you emerge into a new system in the 80s. But it's a loss of power, really. Like, Curtis really confuses the matter on this, I think. I think it's one of the worst things about him. He wants us to believe that the markets took power, and he wants, implicitly, I think, maybe I'm reading him wrongly, but a reassertion of the power of the state over markets because he thinks it's morally wrong that it's not in the hands of the state. But I think he's wrong.
I have this bit from Michael Hudson, which suggests that one of the things that the British government did lose its control over was real control over their monetary policy. Basically, because Britain was broke after World War II, they had to give up what controls they had, effectively leaving sterling at the will of the market, in a way that the dollar was not, because of course they can always turn the pumps on, especially post Nixon. So that is something that he points to as a hidden control mechanism, whereby America can manipulate what the world market does simply by destabilizing the global economy by flooding it with dollars over and over again. And that is something that he points to in this period where, for example, he mentions that during this period in the 70s, America basically threatened all of its allies, including Britain, that unless they took American goods on favorable terms, including a fixed portion of agricultural goods, that is food, unless they agreed to those terms America would not take steps to stabilize the dollar. So there, what there is a hidden leverage mechanism by America here, whereby it has the power to destabilize and even crash all of the economies of its of creditor nations, i.e., nations that own American debt. So that is something. I mean, I did a stream on that the other night, but I encourage everybody to read that book by Hudson, because it was a bit of an eye opener for me. Anyway, let's continue.
Of savage cuts in public expenditure. It was the only way, he believed, for Britain to get a loan from the IMF and avoid bankruptcy. But it was clear to many in his party that he had given away control of the economy to the markets.
I'm going to negotiate with the IMF on the basis of our existing policies, not changes in policies. And I need your support to do it. But when I say existing policies, I mean things we don't like as well as things we do like. It means sticking to the very painful cuts in public expenditure on which the government's already decided. That's what it means, and that's what I'm asking for. That's what I'm going to negotiate for, and I ask the conference to support me in that task.
Can I just say that despite all the bluster and despite all the rhetoric, what he's saying is, I am basically going to do what the IMF says, which is impose austerity, because that's all the IMF ever does when they get involved. So he's making it seem like a position of strength, but he's actually just doing what any country does where the IMF intervenes. So
The way you feel the conference turn on him.
Yeah, you can feel this. You can feel it in the room, can't you?
Pause 1 second.
Go on,
I just wanted to add something to that. Yeah, just to add to what you guys just said. I mean, this led to a break in the Labour Party as well. Obviously, that after they lost power in 79, they then went to war, like internal war within the Labour Party for another like 2 or 3 years after that. Really bitter, openly fought, you know, on TV, in the papers, and everything. And one side was Healey. Neil Kinnock joined the right-wing sort of side, but having been from the left, Tony Benn led the left-wing side. Jeremy Corbyn was part of that as well. People like Chris Mullin, the Bennites, right, and they were for socialism, you know, and they were for what they called a siege economy, and basically just, you know, implied in the word siege economy, right, like literally trying to shield themselves from world capitalism, just by force, really. Just forcible sort of state control of the economy is cutting off from the rest of the world to the extent the rest of the world's a problem. And that played out across the whole rest of the 80s up until Blair took over, really.
Yeah, interesting bit of history, that. So basically the hard left won that internal battle initially, but then they lost it when Kinnock came in, and then ultimately when Blair came in. Yeah,
they got control of some of the party institutions, but they didn't get enough and they were defeated. If anyone wants to watch, there's a series, I think it's on YouTube, it's called Labour, The Wilderness Years, and it's all about that. It's a very good documentary.
Arab money now flooded back into London, and it became one of the mainstays of the British economy. Much of it went to buy arms. 10 years before, David Sterling had begun arms exports to the Middle East as a way of influencing Arab nations. But now it was just business. The Grenadier Guards greeted their customers in Arabic, simply in order to get their money.
Al-Faras, Al-Sharah, Al-Zawqa, Al-Sahia, Grenadier Guards, Jahid Seyfi, Tom Kudikum, Saidi.
The process that Sterling and people like him began became cynical. It became, we're going back to see the Saudis because we want part of this big money they're hoarding back. How dare they, you know, amass so much wealth? So it wasn't the same romantic idea.
How is business at the moment? What sort of deals are you pulling off?
Well, very good at the moment. I think that there's an enormous amount of business in the world.
We've signed a number of deals in the Middle East, for instance, in the area of 700 million, another one for 200 million, deals in the offing, which could add up to 1,000 million. And I think it's part of a natural courtesy.
Very smug, isn't he? Very smug. Mm.
That 700 million is about 5.5 billion in adjusted pounds today.
To these people, to make sure that they have a very pleasant stay in Britain, then they might actually buy it.
If you went to one of...
He reminds me a little bit of Mr. Salt from the Wonka film. Same physiognomy and smugness.
Mayfair's hotels in the middle 70s and sat in the lobby, you would be surrounded by mixed groups of people huddling over paper, trying to exchange information about some kind of a deal in the making, mostly whispering because it always involved commissions, you know, doing this, exchanging specifications, getting secret tips of how to handle it, telling somebody, you know, we have the approval of the cabinet. And this is where corporate corruption in the UK started. And this is where the corruption of people in government also started. They started paying members of the government commission to facilitate the deal itself. And so we've gone full circle by looking the other way and sanctioning corruption. Corruption has eventually come back to infect the institutions of this country.
David Stirling finally retired for good, but not to his family castle. Because of debts, his family were forced to sell it to an Arab businessman.
Oh, no.
Stirling's mercenaries returned home after 20 years of trying to keep Britain powerful. The country they came back to was very different from the one they had left.
I found a rather sad Britain in many ways. I found corruption creeping in more and more in government, in local government, and in private life. And I must admit that I wasn't very happy with what I saw. So in many ways, the Britain that I had been projecting in the Middle East and in Africa and in the Far East was not the Britain which really existed. And I found that very sad.
Well, I don't know about you, but I think you've had your money's worth. All the way now, but always remember, be like Harry Lauder and keep right on to the end of the road. Keep right on to the end. Though the way be long, let your heart be strong. Keep right on around the bend. And though you're tired and weary, still charge
those comments about corruption at the end, it must mean a new kind of corruption had crept in. I mean, obviously there was corruption before, but I'm interested what the guy at the very end, the English guy, saying that you know, that it was actually quite new to him to see how much corruption was creeping into everything in Britain. That's interesting. I'd like to hear more about that. Obviously, in later episodes of this, of the Mayfair set, we see certain kinds of corruption to do with Harrods and things like that. But I wish he went into that more.
I mean, I wonder if it's something as simple as everything realigning to the American way of doing things, which is more obviously corrupt. I mean, the emphasis in this documentary was on Britain becoming more like the Middle East. But the actual hegemon in the world at this point was America, which sets the tempo. And I just wonder, you know, some of these, like, you know, when they were talking about the commissions earlier on, I mean, in America, I don't think anybody would bat an eyelid for those sorts of things, even in the 1920s, let alone...
There was some mention of that when we did the Black Power episode. I think there was some mention of how that contrasted with American corporate culture. But yeah, I think there was a lot less, inhibition about, you know, just let's say direct business practices in America.
There's more what's in it for me. I mean, you know, at the electoral level, I mean, it's that, you know, if certain areas vote a certain way, they get a defense contract.
And what AA said about like American agriculture exports a few minutes ago, that's a product of American domestic politics, as in senators in places like, you know, with massive agricultural production going on. They tend to just be lobbyists for agricultural subsidies. And that includes often just forcing American farmer interests through, like, you know, through the World Trade Organization, things like that. And America tends to be quite naked about it. Yeah, if there's a senator who the government relies on, and that senator relies on whatever lobby, then it just becomes like world trade policy sometimes.
Absolutely. And that book I mentioned it goes into all of how those two things, American domestic policy and American foreign economic policy, how they actually intertwine in a system that mutually benefits, the government, to say the least. Not less convinced that it benefits the people of America, but it could artificially keep them in jobs and things like that. You know, you could argue.
It's the bit in Godfather 2 where Michael Corleone says to the guy, Senator, we're both part of the same hypocrisy.
Yes, indeed. Just a few super chats, chaps, before we get out of here. Port Film Co-op says, before we get onto those, thoughts about episode one of Mayfest set and how it stacks with the rest of the Curtis, the 14 other Curtises we've seen?
I think it stands slightly apart, actually, from the other three episodes in this series. It still has a sort of feel similar in some way to the Pandora's Box style of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. He hasn't necessarily gone as fully kinetic. I think it that develops more as we go on in the series. And I've got some thoughts, which I sort of maybe will spill out as we go on the Mayfair set, because it sort of amps up a bit more. And I think it's a kind of workmanlike episode, this one, but I think the other three are more exciting, and they're kind of more linked together by the dynamism of the characters, Tiny Roland, James Goldsmith, and to an extent, Jim Walker as well in the next episode.
That's how I see this series as well, exactly like that. The first one is the quietest one,
yeah,
and it gets more exciting. So
yeah, it's much more the casino kind of feel in the next three.
Port Film Co-op says one director similar to Curtis is Lutz Dammerbach, who made the films The Net, The Unabomber, LSD and The Internet, and Over Games. The latter is about post-war experiments done on Germans via sadistic TV game shows made by American psychologists. Have any of you guys seen any Lutz Dammerbach films?
No.
Never heard of him before, but that's interesting.
Prepared to look.
He also says, before getting to the big ones like Century of the Self, I suggest an interval purely focused on Curtis parodies and critiques, such as a handful of hilarious spoofs, and James Corbett's longer critique, Adam Curtis, Establishment Contrarian.
Yeah. I didn't know Corbett had done a thing on Curtis. Interesting. I like Corbett.
I'd maybe second that in a way, because we did miss out one Curtis to get here today. We missed out the Way of All Flesh, because it's about cancer, which is, you know, a bit of a hard sell on a Wednesday afternoon.
One I definitely want to do at some point is, do you remember he did the shorts on Charlie Brooker?
Yeah.
Like Odearism and The Rise and Fall of the Journal. I was thinking about doing all of those in one, because they're only like 10 minutes each, collecting them all and doing one on the Curtis shorts. Not sure about doing the whole parodies and critiques thing, maybe as a postscript, maybe after we finish.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of interesting notes I've taken on the kind of the influences of Curtis, which I dug into a bit and, you know, could save for that kind of stream.
Would you know, there's a danger it won't get 7,800 views either. So.
There is a danger that this episode actually won't make, but because we did it at 5 p.m., which is earlier than usual, which means a smaller audience than usual, not a particularly thrilling topic. Well, I think it is, but, you know, for the normie masses, it's not like, you know, Churchill and World War II, which is an automatic sell for everybody. This is a bit more niche. So, but I still think it should make 7.8 easily. Wolf Larson says, greetings from Midwest America. Does an empire begin its slow, inevitable decline upon the establishment of its bank? In England, 1694, for example, US, 1913, degrading effect of endless borrowing, lending, and acquisition. I mean, this is just my view, but if you say that the British Empire started its decline in 1694, you're basically saying it was in decline before it even started. You know, the British Empire that everybody thinks of. Obviously, there was the Elizabethan English Empire, you know, which had the colonies and a few other bits and bobs. But really, the empire proper starts in and around then. John Bagot Glubb says the high noon of the British Empire was during in the middle of the reign of Queen Victoria. That is its high point and also the beginning of the end.
Interesting point. I remember about 1694, if you want a sort of a waypoint of decline, it was the year that women gained inheritance rights.
Interesting. Very interesting.
You could put a similar question. Would Britain have had an empire without the central bank? Would you know, do empires come about without central banks? I mean, obviously in ancient times they did, but I mean, in the modern age. And is it, you know, you could ask, do central banks mean that you'll ascend rapidly because of the availability of credit and you'll decline disastrously? I think there's a strong argument to be made for that. So, yeah, it's an interesting question. I think yes is the answer. Obviously, the ascendance came after 1694, though.
I would see it more in terms of the full eternal caste, you know. Obviously, the peasants never actually gained power, so forget about them. But there's three other elite groups, the warriors or the soldiers, if you want to put it that way, the merchants and the priests.
And they all went to the Claremont Club.
Britain, in its ascendancy, clearly had a warrior class and a merchant class who worked worked together, right? And they had mutual interests, but there was enough of the warrior type to, you know, keep things going. And this is John Bagot Glubb's argument. What happens after that high noon point is basically the merchants gain too much of the upper hand and the balance is lost. You know, so the warrior types become subordinate to the merchant types, which is kind of also the thesis of this documentary as well, which is
Hitchens's point about, you know, the massacre of the warrior caste in World War One, and that is a sort of beginning point of decline.
Yeah. In the American case, it's harder to say because that seems to be a pure merchant empire. I don't know if it ever had a you know, obviously there are American generals and things, but I mean, I would say even in their life, even in the lifespan of American ascendancy, the predominance of merchants over warriors has intensified. You don't get people like Patton in public life anymore. Or even look at somebody like Colonel Douglas MacGregor. You know, he's obviously a lion type, but he is sidelined and marginalized and not allowed near power and is replaced with managers, basically. So... Spasticus Autisticus says, for a long time, bribery of foreign officials was not criminal. The Bribery Act in 2010 changed this. E.g., in 2017, Rolls-Royce were fined £500 million under it. So Rolls-Royce got a massive fine under the Bribery Act. He also says, American anti-bribery legislation was passed in 1977, but real enforcement only began in 2005. And seems protectionist, mostly against non-US companies.
Sounds right.
I mean, if there's American anti-bribery legislation, I would suggest that's very selectively enforced, given how much of their politics are influenced by certain lobby groups. Coney says, David Sterling living the life of Big Boss from Metal Gear Solid, commanding his diamond dogs. What an absolute Chad. I'm in complete agreement that the buccaneer spirit should return again. So there we are. Well, if there were more people like him around, maybe we wouldn't be in such dire straits. But don't forget, he ultimately failed in his endeavors as well.
Yeah. I have a feeling he might have been slightly autistic, actually. The guy I knew who worked for him, he just told me an interesting anecdote about the way he would operate. He was kind of egalitarian in the way he ran the SAS regiment. You know, everybody could kind of, it was sort of without hierarchy at the operational level. People, they do what they call the Chinese parliament. Everybody puts their bit in and the officers, you know, coordinate and listen. And the guy with the best idea really comes out on top in a way. And he said something very interesting about Stirling. He said when you would talk to him, he would kind of look straight ahead. He wouldn't really look at you, but he would listen very intently and really consider what you said, and then give his kind of, address to what you pointed out, a rebuttal or maybe an agreement. But it sounded like he sort of socially he might have been somewhat like that, slightly hyper focused, let's say.
Interesting. And that is it for the super chat. So what do you chaps, I mean, we may return to the, I had to move it earlier. We may return to a later time slot next week, but you chaps in for the long haul for the whole four parts of Mayfair set next week?
Yeah. If the audience can put up with it. Yeah. I mean, it's a bit longer than watching just the episode, but if you just want to watch the episode without people talking, go and watch the episode. It's fun to parse it and pick it apart. And there's lots to say about Curtis's style that we can sort of broach as we come up.
Just one thing about that. At the end, he did like a little burst of Land of Hope and Glory just as something ludicrous was happening. That's peak Curtis, that.
Yeah, he does
pompous, that. Pompous positive music over absurd decline, you know.
Yeah. That footage of the Arab walking around the arms show. I mean, I've been at that arms show. Is called DSEI, which is held at the EdXL Centre in London yearly. And I've been to a couple of those things. And that is kind of like how it is. You know, you've got all these kind of stalls where people are sort of selling their whatever, you know, guns, ration packs, gas masks and stuff. And there's a big stall in the centre, which is run by BAE, British Aerospace. And their stall is not really a stall. It's like a little hub. It usually costs about $1 million. And it's kind of like a sort of VIP room. And you see kind of these guys being ushered in there.
Yeah, I just kind of wonder, like, Curtis, I mean, the big takeaway from a documentary like this, if you're watching it in 1999, is country's not powerful anymore. It's basically fucked. It's corrupt. It's corrupt as hell. And that's it. I mean, he's just giving people like, you could argue that Curtis is like, blackpilling the public in a way. That'd be something to think about as this goes forward.
I generally think of his stuff as blackpilling, usually. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a theory about that. I can bring that up next time.
All right. Well, I look forward to it. I remind everyone, do buy my courses, join the channel, like and subscribe. Horus, where can people find you?
Yeah. Eternalhorus.substack.com.
Simon, where can people find you?
Mainly on Twitter @Simon_Roberts.
Thank you very much. Do follow both these gentlemen. Support Horus on Substack as well. And I will see some of you later on when I appear on this stream with Aris Press. That is tonight at 10 p.m. Aris Press. I've given the link in the community notes. And so long for now.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.